From NPR News, this is News in No Time. Tony Cox in for Farai Chidea. Hope, disbelief, and a renewed faith in the American dream. These are some of the thoughts being expressed today by many African Americans who, quite honestly, never thought they'd see the day a black person would actually be within reach of occupying the White House. But now that Senator Barack Obama has clinched the Democratic nomination for president, we're going to talk about the impact of that historic event from a generational perspective. With me today is civil rights icon Reverend Joseph Lowery, who co-founded the Southern Christian Leadership Conference and was a confidant of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. We are also joined by Afi Odelia Scruggs, an independent journalist and writer. Thank you both for coming on.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Reverend Lowery, first off, tell us how you felt the night that Obama clinched the number of delegates needed to secure the Democratic nomination and gave his speech.
Well, when I got up off the floor, I brushed myself off. Oh, frankly, it was a warm and very spiritual feeling. In the Old Testament, and you know you got a preacher here, so you may have some biblical references, which I hope doesn't violate anything on public radio.
You go right ahead.
But the Old Testament talks about the year of Jubilee has come. I think this is a Jubilee experience. Frankly, I never dreamed that I would live long enough to see the American promise turn toward reality in the body politic in such fashion. It's a great moment, and I think Barack Obama was right when he said, America, this is our moment. It's not a black moment. It's not a Democrat Party moment. It's truly an American moment, for this is what America has claimed to be.
Well, let me ask Afi, what was your response when you, that night, the same way that Reverend Lowery described his?
I went on Facebook to write on my niece's wall. She's 22. She lives in Chattanooga, Tennessee. And what I was struck by was the fact that she said that she was happy her 91-year-old great-grandmother, my grandmother, lived to see the moment. And after I responded to that, I called my grandmother's sister, who is in her 80s, and we have been sharing this since Iowa, and we just talked about the span of her life and the span of my life and how miraculous this is. We've been using the word miraculous quite a bit.
Reverend Lowery, looking back through the civil rights struggle, is there an event, a singular moment, or a specific thing that you can point to that brought us to this day with a black man conceivably winning the White House?
Well, I think we have to go back to, oh my God, we can go to so many places. The first thing that came to mind was 1957, when Martin stood in Washington at a prayer pilgrimage and cried, give us the ballot. We had not yet the right to vote in many, many states in this country. And Martin saw the ballot as a means of unlocking doors that had been closed and locked against justice and liberty for generations to come. And then I have to go again to the Voting Rights Act, which came as a result of that cry and the Selma to Montgomery movement, which removed barriers and restrictions from voting, and not only permitted African Americans to vote, but permitted African Americans to run and to seek public office. Those are two of the instances that come to mind, and I could whip my memory box and come up with some more if I had to, but those two come to mind at the beginning.
Afi, let me put this question to you. Do you think that black people have been wrong about how whites see African Americans, or do you think that that perception has changed, embodied by the nomination of Barack Obama?
No, I don't think black people have been wrong about how whites see African Americans. I live in Ohio, and Barack didn't take Ohio. We haven't been able to elect a black person to a statewide office in Ohio since I've lived here, and I moved here in 1990. However, I do think his victory gives us inspiration and shows us that the overcoming is possible. I think we had been so beat down that we had forgotten that we have the power. We can flex our muscles, and we have flexed our muscles in the past. Joseph Lowry, Reverend Lowry, can talk about that. I think our people had lost hope, and I think this has given us hope in our power again.
If Reverend Lowry, if Obama were to lose in November, how much would that change the euphoria that so many African Americans are experiencing at the moment? And would it signal, do you think, that things haven't really changed all that much?
I'm not even going to think about it. I think that we're on a roll. And I think the American people, you know, when Martin cried, and on August 28th, when they officially named Obama the Democratic nominee, it will be exactly 45 years since the March on Washington, when Martin cried, you know, don't judge us by the color of our skin, judge us by our character. And I think that's what the American people have done. American voters in these primaries and caucuses have felt a pull at their heartstring. They've felt deep speaking unto beep, and they have responded without regard, without restriction of color and gender. For as a matter of fact, I think we have to consider that as a mark of progress as well. But I think that's going to catch on, and I think it's going to continue through November, and I think we're going to see Barack Obama reap the benefit of people looking at the candidates through commitment, through intellect, through character, and through the belief and faith in their determination to turn the page in this country's history.
Afid, to follow that point, Reverend Lowry's point, how much of a difference do you think Obama being elected president would make to the everyday lives of not only African Americans, but white Americans as well?
Oh, I think it would be revolutionary. I just want to say, though, that you don't get a revolution without pain. And in this country, you have to realize that white identity is built upon notions of supremacy. I think it would be very, very traumatic to the established notion of white identity, because now, in order to admit that someone is your equal, you have to acknowledge you are not superior. So I think on that issue or that point, we're going to see a sea change. In terms of African Americans, I think it could be revolutionary for us, because we will really have no excuses. It doesn't mean that racism doesn't exist. It doesn't mean it's not institutionalized. But we cannot say that it is more powerful than we are, or that our efforts cannot defeat it. So I think that it could be quite traumatic, quite painful, and quite joyful at the same time.
Reverend Lowry, there has been talk for some time now, I know that you are aware of this, about whether there is still a need for a civil rights movement as we have known it because of the changed outlook on race by younger Americans. Is Obama's nomination evidence of that?
That we don't need a civil rights movement?
Not in the way that we have in the past.
Well, I'm glad you qualified it, because we've not reached our goal. Obama's nomination nor his election will mean the automatic elimination of all racial disparities and racial discrimination in this country. We would have reached another level, another high mark, but we'll still have a long way to go. And I think we always must remain vigilant. We always must insist that the standards and the barometers used to measure progress and to measure justice respect the commitment to move beyond race and gender and color and creed and et cetera. It's a new beginning. There is no automatic end to racism and racial restrictions because of this nomination, nor even because of the election. Yes, we will still need vigilance and determination to keep the nation honest.
Do you think that Barack Obama's involvement in politics to the point that he has reached so far, are there already signs that there is a coattail effect for others who would aspire to something as high as this?
Well, I don't think there's any doubt but what he's had a sweeping effect across the country, and many candidates for office are now hoping that they will be swept into office, and so do I, because it would be tragic if he ends up with a Congress that is, you know, that expresses antipathy toward his objectives and his ideals and his commitment. So I would hope that his coattails are wide. I hope that he gets the kind of Congress that will support him and work with him. And I think the people's mandate will help in that and will help influence Congress. But yes, we're going to have to continue to hope that his coattails are wide.
Final thing for you, Afi, is this. Do you think that African-Americans in particular, the electorate, we know that it has been energized for the primary, but will it continue through the general, do you think, the general election?
Yes. Yes. I definitely think so. I think Americans in general are much more sophisticated about the political process. I think African-Americans had been feeling disillusioned and disenfranchised. I'm really hoping that African-Americans will turn the hope into work. And I'm optimistic about that. I'm optimistic about that. My 88-year-old aunt is talking about taking people to the polls in Chicago. She has to. So when I hear that, then I feel like, you know, the efforts are going to be there. Folks are going to hit the street. People understand that this is going to be a victory that will be very narrow, and we're going to have to work to get it.
In 10 seconds, Reverend Lowry, is this the mountaintop that Reverend King was talking about?
Well, it's approaching it. It's at least another plateau. And I don't say we're at the top yet, but we're climbing in the right direction, and we're our faces turned toward the city of justice and the city of hope and the city of promise. And I think Barack's spiritual presence has had such a positive impact on citizens, black and white, brown and red and yellow. And I hope it will continue, and we will see this as the beginning of a new era.
This is where we have to stop, Reverend Lowry. Thank you very much, sir. Reverend Lowry is a veteran civil rights leader. He co-founded the Southern Christian Leadership Conference with the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King. He was joined by Afi Odelia Scruggs. She is an independent journalist, writer, and digital storyteller. She joined us from WCPN in Cleveland, Ohio. This is News in Notes. I'm Tony Cox. Presumptive Democratic nominee Barack Obama and his now former rival Hillary Clinton met in private last night for the first time since Obama clinched the Democratic nomination. Two of the Air Force's top military leaders are forced to resign after a shipment of U.S. nuclear warheads are accidentally shipped to Taiwan, and U.S. diplomats are detained by Zimbabwean police. In a few moments, we'll talk about those headlines with two of our regular journalists on Reporters Roundtable. But first, Hillary Clinton is reportedly going to wrap up her presidential campaign tomorrow. We get the latest now from Beth Fooey. She covers presidential politics for the Associated Press. Welcome, Beth.
Thank you.
A lot has been written about Hillary's expected concession tomorrow to Barack Obama. But before we talk about that, the two former rivals met last night at Senator Dianne Feinstein's house. What happened there?
One of these political scavengers for the media, they met private. Senator Obama's traveling press was made aware of this until they were taxiing down the runway on the way to Chicago. So it left everybody scrambling to figure out going on.
Beth, let me interrupt you. We're having some technical problems hearing you. We're going to see if we can fix it and come right back to you. And in the meantime, we're going to run into Reporters Roundtable with the guests who are with me now. We are joined by Bob Butler, who is an independent journalist and president of the Bay Area Black Journalists Association. Also with us is Aaron Aubrey Kaplan, a contributing editor at the LA Times op-ed section. Hello, folks.
Good morning.
Hi, Tony.
It's nice to see both of you. We were going to try to get back with Beth as soon as we can, and she was going to talk about what happened last night between Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton. But let me ask you, both of you, starting with you, Aaron, are you getting the sense that both candidates are doing now what they can to reunite the party post-Tuesday?
I think so. That's a tall order. It's going to take more than a meeting at Dianne Feinstein's house. This is also unscripted, you know, unprecedented. It's very hard to know what unity will look like a week from now, 2 weeks from now, a month from now. I just want to just say for the record how astounded I am that you know, Barack Obama has the nomination. It feels surreal almost. So, and the whole idea of unity, you know, will be, I think it's going to be redefined, really.
Really? Let me ask you, Bob, you know, did you see Hillary's speech on Tuesday night?
I did.
And the tone of it was one that the Barack supporters were not expecting. It was not as conciliatory as they had hoped. What would you expect her to do and sound like and say on Saturday?
Well, based on the speech the other night, I really don't know what to expect, because I thought she was going to give a concession speech and basically, you know, tell her supporters to support Barack Obama. But obviously she's still holding on to hope of getting something. And, you know, her question, what does Hillary want? Well, I think nobody is going to be surprised that she wants to be the VP now. I'm looking forward to hearing what she has to say, because if she comes out and says, okay, you know, for me, I'm done, and Barack Obama is the nominee. And I know all you people have said that if I'm not the nominee, you know, you're going to vote for John McCain or won't vote at all, but don't do that. Vote for Barack Obama. That's what she needs to do in order to get the Democratic Party back together.
Erin, you think she really wants to be VP?
Oh, absolutely. She said so, which is kind of unusual that she kind of announced, yes, I want to be VP. And in a way, she still I think she wants to control this thing somehow, even though she's not the nominee. I think that is absolutely bad for party unity. Essentially holding a gun to Barack's head, saying, I want to be your running mate. And he has said, I'm going to, you know, he's gotten a committee together, and he said, you will hear from me when I pick my running mate. But it's still a weird tension. Like Bob said, it does not feel over in that sense. And that, I think, is, you know, there's still a lot of unease out there.
Well, to follow that point, within the last couple of days, there's been a big movement on the internet for Clinton supporters who are vowing to support John McCain. In fact, the response has been so strong, there are even reports that the Republican National Committee has bought the domain ClintonForMcCain.com, if you can believe that. Clinton and Obama
are
pretty similar on policy issues. So why would a Democrat switch loyalties like that? Is it there that much anger against Obama, or anger because Clinton lost?
You know, I think a lot of the Clinton supporters felt like, especially the women, felt like, hey, we have a chance to put a woman in the White House. You know, and this was actually her best shot. And I believe if Barack Obama was not in the race, she would be the nominee. But he came in and he really energized a lot of people. He got the young people involved. But I think there are still people in this country that will not vote for him because of his skin color. That's no other way to say it. And those people say they would rather support a McCain than vote for a black man, which I think is wrong. That's why it's so important for Hillary to tell these people, no, if you support me, you got to support him.
Now, she could tell them that, Erin, but her 18 million supporters don't have to do what she says. Do you think she can deliver those votes for Obama?
You mean if she's on the ticket?
Whether she's on the ticket or not.
In
terms of party unity,
absolutely.
Can't she do
well,
it?
I think that's the power she's wielding. She's kind of holding over his head, saying, you know, unless such and such happens, you're not going to get those votes. I can deliver those votes. And there's still a sense that, you know, that's what I mean when I say she's in a way sort of controlling this process. And the idea, though, that her supporters would even think about voting for McCain, who is so against a lot of principles, not just Democratic principles, but feminist principles, et cetera, is really astonishing and speaks not just badly of the party, but of this country. And I have to agree with Bob that people, there's a resentment about Hillary, sort of this, you know, she was robbed. This moment was taken from her, robbed her of the chance of being the first woman nominee, but also that she was robbed by a black man. I think that resentment makes it run that much deeper.
Well, let's go inside the Obama camp for a moment, if we could pretend to do that. How badly does Obama need those 18 million votes in order to beat John McCain in November?
I think he needs some of those votes. There's no question about that. Whether he needs all of them, I can't tell you. I don't have that map that they have on CNN where they can punch up all the different scenarios. But I think he needs some of them. And I think without getting Hillary Clinton supporters, it'll be tougher for him to win. I mean, let's face it, there will be a lot of people that won't vote for Obama simply because of his color, which, you know, in this day and age, we've talked about how much progress we've made. Yes, we have. But you have some people that are going to run, you know, they're going to just go back to their roots and the way that they really feel, and they're not going to do it. A lot of other people will vote for him because he is a person of color, mm-hmm. and also because of what he stands for. But I think he does need some of those Clinton supporters.
Let's talk a little bit about McCain and Clinton as well, because McCain is now challenging Obama to 10 town hall meetings. Here's how he put that.
I think Americans are tired of the ways presidential campaigns have been run in the past. All the gimmicks, the phony sound bites and photo ops, campaigns that always seem to be more about the candidate's interests than the public's. And I hope that Senator Obama agrees. Joint town halls would show we both understand that this election couldn't be more important to the future security and prosperity of American families.
So, one-on-one, who do you like in a one-on-one between those two in a town hall? To whose benefit is this?
Well, of course, John McCain is hoping it's to his. He's done pretty well in those mm-hmm. kind of, yeah. you know, his straight talk expresses. I think he does well in that form, but I think Barack does well in that, too.
Yeah, I mean.
He shows his charisma. I actually went to an Obama rally to see what the fuss was about a year and a half ago, which seems like a lifetime ago, and I got it. And McCain, I hear, plays well in that setting too. So it'll be very interesting.
Yeah, I think for Obama to do well in a situation like that, he has to basically just be himself. And what McCain's going to try and do, to my way of thinking, is he'll try to say, well, look, but you don't have the experience to do the kind of stuff that I've done. And Obama's response, of course, would be, well, yeah, but you're not changed. You're the same old stuff. And in a town hall setting, it depends on who the people in the crowd are and what kind of reaction you're going to get. If the Republicans can get a lot of their people in there that support McCain, then of course it'll seem like McCain wins all of the debates. They talk about having an independent commission, bring the people in. I'm always suspicious of that because some parties have been very, very good at stacking the deck in their favor, depending on where you are.
Are you surprised, either of you, Aaron or Bob, that the polls show currently that McCain and Obama are in a virtual dead heat?
No, I'm not surprised. This is completely unscripted, unprecedented. I never know week to week where Obama's going to land. So I'd say for this, it's like right now they both got an A in class, and it's theirs to lose.
Right. Yeah, there's no question. McCain has a lot of the support of the old diehards, the GOP, even conservative Democrats who would like to support him. But Obama has the young people who have come out in tremendous numbers to support him. So a dead heat right now, I don't think is a surprise. What's going to end up making the difference, I think, are the debates and are as we get down the road in the campaign. And we haven't seen the robification of Obama yet. And we know that's going to be coming. Although I don't know how much dirt they can dig up on Obama. I mean, I'm sure there's some things, but it seems to me like he's a pretty clean cut guy, and there may not be much to dig up on.
But, I have to say one thing, and that is this gets to the conversation you had earlier about this whole, Obama's nomination. That is, whatever, even if there's no dirt to dig up on him, this is a question of national identity. People vote president. They vote in a presidential election. They're voting for a guy who will represent them. And the idea of a black man representing all of us is a really radical one. And that's what we're voting on that we've never voted on before.
And a scary one to a lot of people.
Yes.
Absolutely. Yeah. We're going to have Beth Fooey coming back in just a second. So before I say goodbye to you, do you think that the campaign going forth will be gentlemanly, if I can use that word, or will it be nasty between Obama and McCain?
I think on Obama's part, he's been a very gentleman so far, and I don't know that he'll change that. I don't think that McCain he's been a gentleman too, but in politics, the candidate doesn't control the message anymore. So I think the candidate's going to get nasty, and it may not be because McCain wants it to or Obama wants it to, but because their supporters, their PACs will put these ads on the air. We're going to be hearing about Barack Hussein Obama an awful lot over the next couple of months, and it won't be because McCain wants it to happen.
All right, let me ask you both to just sit tight for a minute. Beth, are you out there?
I sure am.
All right, let's bring you back in. When we last talked to you, you were going to tell us what happened at Dianne Feinstein's house last night when Obama and Hillary Clinton got together. The wires say that she left them downstairs on a sofa with a bottle of water, and she went upstairs to do her work, and she didn't see them again until it was all over. So what did they do? Beth? Oh, we lost her again. Okay, well, cell phone. Maybe when Obama or McCain become president, they can fix the cell phone problems that we have.
Put some more tariffs
on. That's why I asked you guys to stick around just in case.
Okay.
So we were talking about the fact that it may be that the candidate doesn't control the message all the time. Well, you don't buy that?
Well, McCain has said this before. I mean, and one positive thing, McCain, who was slimed himself back in 2004 by, mm-hmm. you know, racially, by the way, has pledged, I'm not bringing that dirt into the campaign. But he has said, I think it was over an ad that aired not that long ago. I don't even remember the ad, but he said, I didn't like that ad, but hey, I can't control the message. I think sometimes that's true. Sometimes it's disingenuous.
That was in the North Carolina?
Yes,
South
in North Carolina.
Carolina. Yeah.
Let me ask you another question, because it seems to me that this time around, more so than in 2004 or in 2000 or going back even before then, that the vice presidential candidate is really going to be important. Do you share that view or no?
I don't think it was important in 2000. Because nobody voted for Cheney. They voted for Bush, and they got Cheney. If Hillary has her way, it's going to be important this year because she'll be on the ticket. I personally don't think that's a smart move on Obama's part, because you don't want to have another Cheney-like vice president who really controls everything, and you're there just kind of being the puppet, which is the way most people perceive the administration now. So I don't know how important. I think it will be important. I'm not sure how important it's going to be, though.
Well, don't you think that Cheney sort of energized that office in a way that it had not been energized before? That's an interesting choice of words.
A little too much energy.
On the Republican side, then, who would be good for McCain?
Oh, gosh. Wasn't there a rumor that Condoleezza Rice was in the running? Because you want that contrast. I think that there is a history of, picking a running mate that is not similar to you, or from a different part of the country or something. And I think, the Obama-Clinton thing would be, they're too similar, frankly. I don't think that
Position-wise.
Of course, different in other ways. But I think, as Bob says, it's too much a sense of it's a Dick Cheney syndrome. She wants to maintain control, which is clear now. And I don't think that would disappear. If she were a running mate,
If she was a running mate, you would have her as the vice president and Bill Clinton as the vice president in waiting,
And that will be the issue, because he's had no trouble making news just as the husband of a candidate. Can you imagine as being the first husband? I mean, people will be seeking him out, asking his counsel, asking his advice on the things that the president's doing. And you don't need to be looking over your shoulder that much.
Well, it looks like we're not going to get Beth back, but so we'll end this on this one quick note. Your take on Michelle Obama? She seems to be rising. Her public persona and the focus on her is now becoming broader as a result, I think, of him. We know that he's going to be the nominee. Mm-hmm. How is she playing out for you?
For me? Yeah. I love her. She's one of, she's my age. She's one of us. I think that what's really making me uncomfortable, and I think the nastiness has started, there's a real zeroing in on what Michelle Obama means. And Americans are looking at her like, why is she doing this? Why is she saying that? What is that fist thing about?
Yeah.
I cringe at this idea that we are now examining black people's culture like it's an exotic foreign species that we've never seen before. We saw it with the Jeremiah Wright things, to some degree. But this is going to get more and more intense, and I shudder to think how she's going to be read in public. I mean, what she means to me doesn't matter. It's how she plays in Peoria.
What do you say, Bob? You get the last word. We got about 30 seconds.
Well, they're making a big deal about the fist bump, but nobody questions the thumbs up, which is a very common, great job.
Or the two hands up with the V, V's, the Nixon V's.
It's partly generational, too. Young people
I guess so.
Yeah, and this campaign will be different from any other campaign going down the stretch, because we're in uncharted waters, and people don't know how to act. And, a lot of these folks, even those of us in the media who are covering this, don't look like us.
Well, that's true. That's true. That's a good place for us to stop. Aaron, Bob, thank you so much for coming in studio. Bob Butler is an independent journalist and president of the Bay Area Black Journalists Association. Aaron Arbery Kaplan is a contributing editor at the Los Angeles Times op-ed section. They both join me here at NPR West. This is News in Notes. I'm Tony Cox. We're going to try now again to connect with Beth Fooey from the Associated Press. We were talking with her about what happened between Senator Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton last night at the Washington, D.C. home of Senator Dianne Feinstein. So, Beth, are you there?
I am.
Okay, we got you this time. So what did they talk about, if anybody really knows?
Well, I don't think anybody really knows except the two of them, because it was a meeting without staff, without any advisors present. Senator Feinstein came out this morning and spoke to reporters. She hosted the meeting at her home. She said that it seemed very cordial. The two sat in comfy chairs in her living room. They sipped water. They talked for about an hour, and that they were laughing as they left. So we know that the mood was fairly pleasant. And what Senator Obama's advisors tell us is that they talked about how to move forward and how to achieve party unity and how to bring together the factions of the Democratic Party that had supported each of the two of them separately, how to bring them both together to now beat John McCain in November.
So was it a bargaining session? Was it my votes for the VP slot, something like that?
Well, actually, we're told by Senator Chuck Schumer, who's an ally of Senator Clinton's in the Senate, that no, they did not discuss the vice presidential chatter. It's hard to imagine that they didn't, though, given the fact that it's what everybody's talking about right now. We know that Senator Clinton has indicated to folks on the Hill that she would be interested in taking the number two spot if Senator Obama were to offer it to her. So it would be like ignoring the elephant in the room if they didn't discuss it. But perhaps just was a more generic conversation right now, and if they're going to get into some specifics on it, they'll have a further discussion later.
Is it true that Clinton plans to retain all of her delegates? And if so, why would she do that?
Well, no, it's not clear yet. Last we've been told is that they're still trying to figure out what to do with respect to her delegates. It's a tough decision for her. I mean, let's face it, Obama did win, but she came very close to him in terms of popular vote and number of delegates. She's behind by about 200 delegates, which isn't a ton, given that there are about 4,000 that were allocated. So if she kept her delegates, it might give her some additional leverage in pushing for things that she wants, whether it's the VP slot or heightened attention to some of the issues that she cares about. But on the other hand, if she's pushing for unity and she's pushing for the party to all come together behind Obama, why would she want to hold out her delegates and kind of give the impression that she might be ready to step back in at the convention if there's some, at that point, concerns or questions about how Obama's faring as the Democratic standard bearer?
Here's my last question. We have about a minute left.
Sure.
A lot was made of the tone of Senator Clinton's speech on Tuesday night. How do you expect, or do you expect, that tone to change tomorrow?
What we're told is that she's going to embrace and endorse Senator Obama wholeheartedly. You're right. On Tuesday night, she seemed to want to make the point that she had won the popular vote, which frankly is a debatable point, that she would be the stronger candidate still against Senator McCain. It was not the speech people expected of her the night that Senator Obama clinched the nomination, as he did that evening. But we're told not to expect that tomorrow. She's going to embrace him wholeheartedly, endorse his candidacy, and urge her supporters to please get behind him as well.
Beth, thank you very much.
You bet.
Beth Fooey covers presidential politics for the Associated Press. Children today face different challenges than their parents did. Keeping them safe is nothing new, of course, but some of the dangers certainly are. Parents and caretakers want to keep their children safe from crime, from drugs, and from gangs. But how do you do that without overprotecting them? And what role do teachers and educators play in their safety? School can be as dangerous a place as the streets. So for one view on that issue, I am joined now by Marisol Sierra, a teacher at McKinley Park Elementary School in Chicago. Marisol, welcome.
Thank you.
Tell us about the circumstances where you teach, the environment, the kids. What's it like there?
Well, we are in the Brighton Park area and the community. There are some gangs in the community, but there is a strong force of parent involvement in the school, where they want their children to come to school to be safe, to learn. And that's what we try to do here at Brighton Park. Our principal, Francis Garcia, tries to let the parents know that their children are safe here at the school. They're coming to be educated and just to learn. But my students, even though the school, we try to provide a safe zone, They come in, they're talking about, teacher, I saw gangbangers, teacher, I saw the gangs in the corner by my house, teacher, I saw in the news, teacher, another kid got hurt, teacher, another child got hurt, somebody died, teacher, a gangbanger did it. And these are 4.5, 5-year-olds. And one of the things before we do our attendance, our nursery rhymes, they always come in and they want to talk about what they heard on the news, what they saw from their neighborhood. And I got to the point where, okay, we can't ignore this. Let's acknowledge it. Let's deal with the issue. And they're talking about, oh, there's gangs at night, teacher, you know, when the lights go out. You can hear gunshots. And
you said something I want to ask you to elaborate on a little bit. You said when they start talking about it, you realize you have to acknowledge it and you have to deal with it.
Yes.
So how do you deal with
it? Well, basically with my little ones, at first, as we sit on the rug, we talk about, I first started telling them, well, I understand that there are gangs. These are big boys that like to hold guns, and sometimes they like to stand in corners and they do things that are not right, like stealing, shooting, because they're like, yeah, they shoot, teacher. They shoot at night, or they write on walls. And one child in my classroom used the word tagging, and I was like amazed that he's 4.5, he used the word tagging. I didn't know he knew what that word meant. And the same thing with the word gunshot. He said gunshot. And I'm thinking, this is a 4.5, going to be 5 years old. That's vocabulary that I would not expect from a child
from
that
a young.
From
a child, yeah.
And then it takes off from one child, and that child elaborates. So then I said, okay, well, let's see. What can we do as a class that we can be safe when we come to school, when we're at home? What can we do? So we all started brainstorming. Teacher, we promise we won't touch guns. We won't talk to gangbangers. And I said, okay, wait a minute. Let me get my paper.
You could write it down.
All right. So let's write it down. We wrote on a paper, we promise not to touch real guns or talk to gangs, because some of these guns look like toys. And our principal, Ms. Frances Garcia, gave us some flyers that show pictures of real guns, but they're colorful. They're pink, and there's a Hello Kitty on one of the guns. They're like pink and yellow, green and yellow, and so, they look like toy guns.
So let me interrupt you to say it presents some challenges for you, it sounds like. And I want to bring into the conversation two students who are here in studio with me from the Los Angeles area to talk about how they deal with it, so the three of us can talk together. Let me introduce them. Angela Bell is a 10th grader at City Honors Charter School in Inglewood, California, and Anna Exiga is an 11th grader at Jordan High School in Watts. Welcome, both of you young ladies.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Now, how do you deal? You've heard Marisol talk about what she has to deal with her really young kids. You guys are high school. Where the violence sometimes is much more severe. Let me begin with you, Angela. How do you navigate through getting from home to school and through school and school to home without having to encounter violence or other kinds of criminal behavior?
Well, I live in South Central, but my dad makes me go to school in Inglewood. So I go to this school called City Honors. It's a charter school. And I have to take the bus every morning to go to school, and most of the days after school. And every day, like, when I get on the bus, I just stick by myself, so I don't talk to anybody, unless it's somebody that goes to my school. I don't talk to anybody, and I just act like I'm not paying attention, so they don't talk to me, so I just isolate myself from everybody else. At least I try. And
do you have to dress a certain way?
I just try not to wear, like, bold, like blue, like a plain blue shirt or red or anything like that, or because, like, they don't care if I'm a girl or not. They just know, like, oh, I could be a Crip or I could be a Blood, so I just don't wear those colors at all. Or I don't wear much brown either, because, like, I have to travel through a whole bunch of different kinds of gangs to get to school, because it's all the way in Inglewood, and in Inglewood, around my school is mainly Bloods, but I live in, like, around a Crip neighborhood, so I can't really do anything. I just dress plain.
Anna, what's your experience?
I wish it was that easy just to sign a little peace treaty that said we won't, you know, commit to doing crimes and violence and all that stuff at Jordan. But, you know, in general, like in all South Central schools that we face, safety is a really big issue. There's always administrators or security guards, like, patrolling the area like some sort of prison. And you could, like, the whole school environment, it feels like a prison. Wow. There's bars around and cameras everywhere, so you feel like you're constantly being watched.
Metal detectors.
Let me ask the both of you before I go back to Marisol. Do you think that you should have or would you like to have been taught at an early age how to deal with this through your teachers and at school, or were you taught how to do that when you were fourth, fifth graders?
I wish somebody would have taught me how to deal with these kind of issues. Like, I didn't even know about anything until I was, like, in the seventh grade, where that's when I first got introduced to all the violence and the gangs.
What happened? Tell us about the first time. Do you remember the first thing?
Yeah, I moved. I used to live in Torrance, and then I moved to South L.A., and, like, after a couple months of living there, like, somebody got shot in front of my house, and they died. So that was, like, really hard for me because I didn't think people actually, like, I watched the news, but I didn't think it would happen, like, that close to me. So it was, like hard for me to, like, handle it. And nobody ever told me, like, oh, people will get shot when you move out here. Oh, you're going to have to worry about gangs, and you can't dress the way you used to dress and stuff like that. So I never knew.
Anna?
Back then, I would have wanted someone to tell me, but I wouldn't want them to sugarcoat it for me.
Yeah.
I would want them to, like, tell me, like, the reality, you know, of this society, with violence and everything.
Marisol, is this helpful to you?
Yes, it is, because what she said, not to sugarcoat it, exactly. I try to let the give the children an awareness. I try to build their awareness for down the road as they go to the higher grades, kindergarten, first grade, third grade, because some of these children might have brothers and sisters or cousins that are in gangs, and they might think they're cool by standing in the corner, because one of my little boys, some of those boys are cool, and I said, no, they're not cool, because they hurt people and they make people sad, and mommies and daddies become very sad if they shoot someone with a gun, or they use it, like one of my little boys, they can use knives too, teacher. And I said, that's right. And I think is just being able to talk to them at their level of understanding that guns and the gangbangers fighting and gangs bring sadness to families, because if you get involved in a gang, someone can get hurt because there's gang violence or guns. If a relative has a gun in the home or for safety reasons, like one of my little boys said, his uncle has a gun for safety reasons. But what about them going and touching it by accident because they don't know that it's, they know that it's real, but sometimes they, you know, video games and everything, they're, oh, I can touch it, you know, I can shoot it and then I won't die.
But let me bring the girls back in. Yes. Do either of you have younger brothers or sisters?
Yeah.
What do you tell them? Are they old enough, first of all, for you to talk to them about what it will be like for them when they get to going to school, or are they already in school?
I have two sisters and a brother, and one of them doesn't even live in California. And then the other two, they're in kindergarten and pre-K. So I try to tell them, like, don't mess with anything like that. But it's kind of hard because, like, there's a lot of gangbangers that live around where they live. So it's kind of hard for them to avoid that. So they, like, know gang signs and all of that already. And my little brother's only 5, 6, and he already knows how to throw up, like, some, like, two different gang signs, and I don't know who taught it to him. And I try to tell him not to do it, but he thinks it's a good thing. So it's hard for them to, like, really understand, like, why they shouldn't do it. They know what it is, but they don't know why.
Anna, are gangs the number one problem in terms of your safety, do you feel, getting to and from school and being at school?
That's one of the main things, and just another thing, it's the community, because a lot of people that go to the South Central schools, they often had to walk their way to school, and a lot of times they see, of course, gangs and drug dealers and all that stuff, so it's really unsafe for them to go to school and then walk back home or take the bus.
Tell me once again. You may have mentioned it earlier. We're going to bring our conversation to a close, and I really do appreciate both of you coming in and sharing your stories. But really briefly, Anna, how do you keep yourself protected? What do you do? What do you try to do all the time?
Well, I take the bus to go home, but I just, like, you know, say to myself, I just, you know, stay quiet, you know, try to avoid everything that's going on. But at the same time, I'm conscious. I'm like, okay, I can't just detach myself from that. I can't just ignore it, because in doing so, it's like being in denial that all this is actually happening.
Same for you?
Yeah. Like how I said earlier about having to ride the bus, like, I act like I'm not really paying attention, but I listen to them. And I'm always looking around to make sure, like, nobody's trying to take my phone or anything like that. So I just...
You try to be careful.
Yeah.
And try to pay attention.
Yeah.
And look out, and you're aware of your surroundings at all times.
Of course. Mm-hmm.
That's a tough way to live. How old are you?
16.
And how old are you?
16.
That's a tough way to have to live at 16. Thank you so much for coming on. Marisol, Anna, Angela. Marisol Sierra teaches at McKinley Park Elementary School in Chicago. Angela Bell is a 10th grader at City Honors Charter School in Inglewood, California. And Anna Exiga is an 11th grader at Jordan High School in Watts.